Point five, sorry, point six, my solution I refer to the Orchard Road Holdings Limited case, which Mr. Zeiss, I understand, produced. I don't actually know why, not what particular point was produced money, but interestingly enough, the help made the couple of other points. So my terms of connections, A, by the way, five, to state in my summary, I just note that that application involves a low density residential development, activity status restricted discretionary. A2 is repeated there, low density residential. Resource intent requires subdivision controlled activity consent under rule 15.2.3.2. Council's controls with respect to lot sizes, averages, and dimensions. Before I pick up on that point, I just happened to notice in the mayor's system, Commissioners Robinson and Stevens in pink, I've highlighted. This is an excellent example of the current regime where subdivisions become RDA because of land use required to purpose. That interpretation issue that I talked about before, and which, by the way, had been cured in this plan, and this plan is which makes the subdivision a part of subdivision. So that's just a good example of the current, the way things currently work. So the whole activity becomes RDA because of that issue, but council discretion is restricted to that issue. But going back to the orange on page 2, control activity, council position is with respect to lot size averages and dimensions. That's actually dropped. I don't know what this decision is being relied on for, but the reference here to lot sizes, this decision is incorrect. And I've attached an A, the rule referred to an A2 is 15.2.3.2. I've attached an A3 to rule 15.2.3.2. Where you'll see bottom left, control of subdivision activities. And I've highlighted in orange the statement, you can follow the site zone centers, you should be a controlled activity. And top of the next column of the matters in respect to which the council has reserved control of a list of these controlled activities. So immediately you see that the statement on the previous page is not a quote from the plan, it's effectively a summary. And then you go to A4, which is lot size, averages, and dimensions, and you find that under lot size, averages, and dimensions, council reserves control of the set before. Lot size, and dimensions, subdivision of land in the town centre, called the shopping centre and marketers park, and the business zones. Interestingly, I just noticed number two, in the question of user, size of the dimensions of lots, access, utilities, reserves, and rights. The point I'm making is that the discretionary control of lot size in the current plan is restricted to identified zones where there's no minimum lot size prescribed. But the statement in that decision that the council in the low density zone of Monaco had discretionary control of lot size is completely incorrect. As a matter of record. Just point that out just in case it's relevant to you will consider it. And a final point, that again, it's a useful example of the next one I'm going to make. On A5, I've highlighted the paragraph, assessing number 15.283, the Liverpool Council have regard for safe and efficient functioning of the road network, effectively in the intersections within the Council's code of practice, safe pedestrian movement, safe spikes of windows of school opportunity for us to get. Now that's, this is the issue of the Council's code of practice. It has been referenced in the district plan as a sensitive matter for the last 15 years. It's always applied. That's a classic paragraph you see here with subdivision consent virtue. The council has control and the council applies this code of practice, its current code of practice, to road users. This is an issue which I kept struggling with in all the sections, all of the documentation the council for hearing, why there was repeated reference to a fear of having some standard rights. And the possible exception of that vice chair's position, no examples of that having risen. So that paragraph there is a good example of what you see and how it feels. Going on with that, my submissions the council's code of practice does always apply. It's currently applied through assessment methods in the current plan. A bit inconsistent, perhaps. I don't know why it's before the section, it might be some of the other sections, but that's a drafting issue. It's always there, it's always applied. It's always the current code of practice. There's not a specific version reference. The council always applies the current code of practice. There's a standing position on every subdivision consent, which I think is confirmed in May of 2021. It says that unless otherwise specified in this consent, you must comply with the council's code of practice. The code of practice details the road which the council requires, which is why I'm not aware of any problem ever in the last 15 years with council having had difficulty granting consent for some standard blood. Why that approach can't be carried forward, either by reference in the assessment methods or in policy, is unclear. And the point seven, I referenced Council's legal submissions paragraph 6.4 on this point, which is interesting the way it's worded. I don't know whether this has been elaborated on since this presentation. The 6.4 links, whether a document is incorporated by reference depends on the way it is referenced in the plan. If a plan speaks for external documents to be complied with in the proposed plan through a rule or standard, to be complied with through a rule or standard will be a trigger for a consent and have legal effect as such, that document will need to be incorporated by reference. By the course of the Park Street Schedule of the RMA. I agree with that completely. What that paragraph doesn't say is if a plan is for a civil document to be in an assessment matter or in a policy. So you don't have to comply with it. It's not a standard.
I think that was covered. That was filled out with the hearing.
Right. So my submission is specifically because it's in an assessment matter or a policy. True, you know, it always has, and council can impose its current code of practice. I'll go one step further. Even if for some legal reason it couldn't, I don't know what that legal reason is, there's some wording in the assessment matter or policy that talks about adequate and appropriate access, then council always apply its current practice because that's the council. Serious was adequate and appropriate access. I just don't understand what this alleged problem is with substandard roads.
Mr. Goldsmith, to fill out that, I had a discussion with Ms. Scott on that specific point, asking her view on the proposition, and I think it might actually be Mr. Ferguson's evidence. That reference to a code of practice that shifting an assessment criteria is permissible. And she couldn't point me to any law on the subject on the spot. We've got a way to look. But during the course of the discussion, we came circled round to the position where perhaps the legal criteria is whether it has regulatory effect. And so what we were mooting was the possibility that the existence of the code of practice be acknowledged at the introduction to the chapter and going down the track that you've mooted of talking about the substance of the matter that has to be addressed. Like the adequacy of access, the adequacy of infrastructure, that these will all be matters of control. So just to fill that out. And that's certainly my recollection of the discussion we had last Monday.
From my point of view, Commissioner, if it's in the assessment matters or policies or in the introduction, it doesn't matter. As long as it's referenced somewhere. And quite frankly, even if the the document is completely silent on it. The council will always oppose this the practice through whatever. If any words about adequacy, appropriate, any words like that in the rule regime, the council will go with code of practice. Now, if it's going to go with code of practice, I would support at least a big reference somewhere, if not in the district plan, so that users actually know that there's quite a big problem. I've only seen the kind of practices, but they didn't print it off, so it's a mess. What have they done? But I guess my primary point here was that supporting my legal submission is that no current problem I did that justifies going from CA to RA. Point 9. And can I say at the outset, I'm going to make some comments on this issue. It doesn't cover the evidence of legal submissions because quite frankly, if the council takes this guidance through policies for assessment matters that nothing can consider my clients. I haven't been briefed to help the council out on the subject, and I have the pleasure. So this whole issue, and this is the issue of the council changing their approach. They're getting rid of assessment matters and aligning policies. At the moment we have operative plan, objectives, policies, rule, controlled activity or RDA, matters of discretion, list, assessments, which guide the discretion. Big change, remove assessment matters completely and rely on policies. As I said, didn't submit on it specifically because it's a technical council thing. But I have to say, like it often does, because of the hearing over the weekend this morning, I started thinking about this issue, and I raised it more as officer of the court as opposed to on behalf of the clients, because I'm concerned that the petition creates a legal problem. I note first that, interestingly, although we've got the assessment matters and got the policies, there's actually no side-by-side comparison here there, which illustrates how the policies do or do not address and achieve what the assessment matters used to. They're just in a blanket change. Really, the assessment matters have policies. No real analysis of the difference between the two. It is, I think, a fairly radical new direction. They have to be corrected, but even myself and any of my panelists are aware of any other council that has adopted this approach, which is part of my take right to fix it. Means I have a habit of setting new laws, getting employed for 20 years, but so we have to do it every time. What led me in part to thinking about this was I've been involved in your community plan and got some important recommendations out last week. So I was sitting reading through the new unitary plan regime, which is precisely the same as the operative regime. It has objectives, policies, control of RDA, matter of discretion, assessments. It's the typical normal approach that we are Queensland is proposing to depart. And I wonder whether we are in danger of creating a potential legal issue. And I point you firstly to policy 27211, which is the very first policy in the subdivision chapter. Yes. Require subdivision to be consistent with the QLDC land development and subdivision code of practice while letting those much easier for innovative design. So, very first policy to require subdivision to be consistent with the code of practice. And the second one, support subdivision systems to be designed by that. So, I'm looking at the first one. Interestingly, when I checked, the plan that notified had no rules to be effective. That policy. There was no subsequent rule regime somehow directing you or telling you to go to the code of practice. It was just a policy that says require and no rule required. That has been fixed up. That issue, I think, has been addressed in the S20's rail report. And I'm going to refer to the latest version, which is Mr. Bryce's just produced version, since that's the version we've been talking about. And I'm sorry, in my written submission, I've been going to refer to the 2773/2755 and 2773/2756. Now, 5.5 and 5.6 are the amended rules that Mr. Bryce and Mr. Cross have produced over the weekend. And if I can turn you to that, 2755. There's a new rule relating to lost drivers about access to loading, no problem with that. Just the next one. I'm writing this as a potential matter of concern. Subdivision design, including whether the subdivision and urban design principles and outcomes set out in the Shorty C subdivision guidelines are achieved. My concern is, and this is actually highlighted in some other rules where subdivision design is separated from achieving the development. Everything else, all the other bullet points there, property access and roading, less demand provision, natural hazards, firefighting, etc., they are a standard list of matters over which the council district's discretion. I'm encouraging you then go to the assessment criteria to help you guide that discretion. I question whether that bullet point, subdivision design is a valid matter of control. I think when you say including whether the subdivision urban design principles now come set out and the guidelines are achieved, are we conflating assessment criteria with matter of discretion? Because what's been crossed out there is the classic, the assessment criteria. Under the operative regime, if you amend this to deal with this issue, your list of matters of control is such subdivision design, and you go to the assessment criteria and you find the extent to which subdivision design principles and outcomes are achieved. Natural control, assessment, that's how you guide the natural control. We're putting them under one. And I'm just not sure when we're creating a problem.
Can I just interrupt you on that?
Yeah.
I understand exactly what you're saying. And you referred to the Auckland Unitary Plan recommendations that have just been released. And to be frank, I'm not averse to plagiarism if it came to assist this district. And I'm wondering whether you could suggest whether the wording used there for both their matters of discretion and their assessment matters would be helpful to us.
Given that, I won't say they're plagiarised, but given that they're not exactly the same process that we have in our operative plan, and the submissions that we have in our operative regime, I suspect you're necessary.
Well, in that case then, perhaps if I cut to the chase and ask you, there's a couple of... do you have a copy of this year?
It was just the basic. It was the structure.
Well, yes, but some of the wording I think is much more useful and helpful. The urban one on page 30. 839 is where the rule commences, which is the method of discretion for restricted discretionary utilities. On page 30, clause 7, all other restricted discretionary utilities. And it says, the effect of the design and layout of sites to achieve the purposes of the zone or zones and to provide access. Is that the sort of more applicable wording that you're referring us to?
Sorry, I'm just looking at it. It looks too large down a little bit. When I first looked at the map of 7 on page 30, my immediate reaction was, it's got the same problem. I would have thought the matter for the matter of control will be the design and layout of sites, the rest will be an assessment matter. I find it rather amusing then to turn over page 31 to have the assessment criteria, and if you flip over to
33,
number 7, the effect of the design and layout of sites to achieve the purpose of the zone or zone of the road site vision would be the access to the level of the
road.
They use identical wording in their matter of control and their assessment matter. Given the pressure that's been issued, it probably doesn't surprise me. But I think my argument would be that the first number 7 should say the design and layout of sites.
Rather than the effect of.
The effect of, and the assessment of should say the effect of.
I agree that the discretion should not be the effect of something, it should just be. I see E under 7E, we also have, we take out the effect of, we just say the layout, design, and pattern blocks, etc., to enable. Those are consistent with the urban design guideline provisions, aren't they?
Yes.
So it's a matter of how they're worded here. And then if we turn to the assessment matters, they repeat them, but they also point you to the policy that they're applying. Is that a helpful way to deal with it?
No chat list keeps changing. She will only assist me to have something in reference to the policy.
Well, I'm just thinking of how helpful it can be for decision makers to actually.
CADC has a column on the right hand side of the page.
Yes.
So, remembers the policy. But which is actually quite a useful cross reference.
Yes. And to be quite frank, that's the theme of the operative plan, is that some parts of operative plan, there's the size standards which don't exist.
I agree. Parts are operative. It's just the fundamental structural issue.
Yes. So I'm just trying to get clear that, that generally, I mean, I understand the issue you're raising. Is it really your submission that we should be looking at including assessment matters in this chapter, irrespective of whether they're in other chapters?
Well, I'm raising the concern on brief reflection that I don't want to be the front of one of the judge trying to explain whether that particular issue is a matter of control or assessment matter or whether it's conflated. If I can just finish that, I'm more worried about 27.56 in the rural lifestyle rule residential zone where, over the page, subdivision design included, colon. And there's four bullet points which are to me assessment matters.
Well, to be fair to Mr. Price, I raised with him in questions last week this problem that was in the notified version of the plan that it had clearly assessment matters listed as matters of discretion. And I think he's tried to fix that quickly.
Yes.
That probably needs more work. It probably would be Mr. Bryson's answer. He only had 2 days which to respond.
I was trying to solve this. I was trying to figure out whether, because there's another one. And that's kind of related to my point 10, where I said comment on district plan structure versus the subdivision design guidelines. What's here? Operative plan, objectives, policies, control, management controls, assessments. This hierarchy, which if you set it out properly, is quite easy to follow. Here we have, we're placing up with objectives, policies, and effectively the subdivision design guidelines. Because the only guidance apart from the objectives and policies is the subdivision design guidelines, which I understand is going to be recommended to be referenced as a specific document, not variable, version 1 draft, may whatever. Only you had the planning commissioners, and I only did myself this morning, to be honest. But if you look at the subdivision design guidelines, the first four pages are take a look at your site before you subdivide, which is if anybody designs a subdivision, is read in, read out. And then there are an analyze your site. Then there's a page on transport connections, a page on street and orientation layout, a page on open spaces, and a page on stormwater management. If you sit side by side and policies prescribe the subdivision design guidelines, apart from the word for, almost word for word, you're dealing with the same issues. And we seem to have a kind of a mess. We've got policies, we've got objectives, policies, and somehow a reference to subdivision design guidelines, which kind of largely repeat the policies, sometimes using a different word. In some cases they add a bit more specificity, but it seems a bit messy. It just seems, to me, I'll put it another way. If you remove from the subdivision guidelines all of the bits that are already mentioned with the policies, you wouldn't have much left on my quick review this morning. So I'm just, this goes back to my, the policy of what you're, the objective where you're going, the policy of the certain things you want to achieve, the assessment strategies you're going to have to get there. Traditional format seems to work quite well, and we've got, we're inventing something new, and it just kind of just seems decent.
Can I just interrupt you for a moment? Does Mr. Brown need to catch a flight this afternoon? I didn't want to put you in the situation we did last time, Mr. Brown.
Having finished on that bit, can I reiterate that neither of our witnesses will need to address any of that. I'm certainly happy to assist you with questions, but they only heard that with you this morning when I told you that. Now, number 11. Before starting, commissioners, do I need to address the fully discretionary regime, or can I take that?
Number 12,
I want to comment on the difference between the recommended RDA regime and the full discretionary regime. Once again, if we go the way the council is currently recommending, deals with this issue.
I don't think we need to discuss that.
Okay. This is the issue of control and loss.
And if you are happy with that, you accept that.
I'm happy with discretionary control over lot size for access roads and services, and not discretionary control loss in the zones which have minimal loss size. that also, if that issue is resolved, I can not produce the exhibition, I can put a line through this.
I have a question that's related to that. I think it's generally, as you've indicated, Mr. Goldsmith, that you accept it, generally accepted that control and or discretion might properly be reserved for subdivision design. It seems to me to be inherent in any change to subdivision design will necessarily have an effect on lot sizes and dimensions. If you shift a road 20 metres west on a site, the lots on one side are going to expand, and the others are going to the ones on the other are going to contract. So I wouldn't want to be left under any illusions that, because it seems perhaps I'm missing something, and I invite you to explain it to me, that a discretion over subdivision design is, to my mind, necessarily has with it a discretion over lot sizes and dimensions.
If I can explain my concern, and I'll come back to the question, which I've kind of set out in point 13. I think it's important, it is probably important that my point 12, which is a reference to chapter 27, 27.1, the paragraph. Basics is that the subdivision chapter is the primary method to ensure the neighbourhoods and quality environments. And 27.3.1 has a direct reference to the strategic chapter, the district wide chapter. 27.3.1 makes sort of cross reference to chapter 3, chapter 6, etc. Which the current district plan doesn't have. And if you end up discretionary along combined, everything is a play, but there's no direct cross reference for the implementation of the chapter. And my concern was, I was trying to find an example, was policy 4237, which I quote at the top of the next page. The edges of urban breakdown that had managed to provide a sensitive transition to rural areas. And my concern was, one of my clients, the development of the underdeveloped residential land on nearby heights. All around Queenstown, the residential zoning of it, also the urban growth boundary zone. So, what happens if something like it turns up with around 600 square metre lots along the boundary, high energy lots, and the council says, well, you know, there's this policy about a sensitive transition to rural areas. So, sorry, we want those lots to be 400 square metre lots, so more transient plants, so the transition is more sensitive. Some of those said, but I've got 2,600 square feet loss, and not only have 10 common square feet loss, and have $1 million each. That cost me $10 million. The planner said, sorry, we have no objectives or policies about your economic return or anything else. That was sorted out when the plan was done. So that's a kind of an example of the potential for some planner to try and bring in district-wide policies to influence the size of lots that somebody can create. Now, in terms of playing around with individual lot size, I accept that the constants of shifting a road, if for some reason, in consultation or in conditions, the council wanted the road to be shifted from point A to point B, or the road shifts, that still means that the subdivision 3 to redesign the subdivision around that to accommodate the council's requirement. The council is not specifying lot sizes. The council is just saying shift to the right. Or the council might say, your subdivision is here, there's a road coming in here, there's a road coming in here, and you have got a link. So we want a link road. The link road. Now, council provides a condition saying make sure your subdivision plan has a road at least 0.8 or 0.8. That may require the subdivider to change his lots around in accordance with the minimum and come up with another solution that gets him the number of lots that he's entitled to have a minimum lot size ratio. There could be a number of other examples, but none of them are the council specifying to the subdivider what that subdivider's lot size should be. That's the issue.
Would a potential solution that might be appropriate in the urban zone, if I'm not so sure in the rural living zone, rural residential, but the application of a maximum average lot size, as well as a minimum average lot size, so that you don't end up with that circumstance of there is a certainty that there is a yield between those bounds. I'm just thinking of this transition area, which I think that would reduce the possibility of some lone tenant wandering off and seeking 1,200 square metre lots.
Sure, there's a difference between maximum average and maximum. If the council has control over whatever the rule is, if the council has discretion to control over it, I'm not sure there's a difference. I guess if the council can.
Well, no, you can make it standard. And breaching the standard is different from having the discretion on the subdivision overall, isn't it?
Yes, I'm still struggling to see, I can fully understand that council may be able to impose conditions to achieve any specific identified desirable urban layout. Road connections, pathway connections, one of them is numbers of rear lots, for example. You should have no more than 15% rear lots. Numbers of rear lots, that's fine. Access with to the house. I just don't think you should be, my solution is that provided the subdivider achieves the urban design outcomes, the subdivider should be free to design this solution. So the council shouldn't actually be saying, well, you know, we should also cover lots there and more 200 lots over there.
Well, I'm just trying to think how to deal with that. Certainly we had evidence from Mr. Brown, I'm not sorry, Mr. Bird, that the transition from urban to rural should be within any urban road boundary. And I don't think there was any counter evidence for that. Would the appropriate way to deal with that then be by zoning? And that the zoning pattern provided that transition?
No.
I mean, I can see your point, and I don't. I can understand the uncertainty created, and I'm trying to think of a way that we can achieve both things, both the transition and the certainty together.
The difficulty with that particular example is that, and you may recollect somewhere of the business solution to change the word sensitive to appropriate, because of course. There's a wider, on that particular issue, there's a wider urban design debate. There's a school of thought that says what I call the English model, and drives the English countryside, and it's an urban rural boundary, it's a hard boundary.
But
well, it's a cat goes up to the fence, on the other side of the fence is a solid house.
We've only got one lot of evidence, though. We've only got this third evidence. And I think the other Valencian architects have equally tended to say the same thing, that the transition should be within the urban growth boundaries, not outside of it.
Depending what the appropriate transition is.
Yeah.
Because the other argument is you should somehow lead from dense to less dense. And that's a whole different design argument, and my submission is that if the council, especially around here where from a semi-residential zone, should we say, down cranked it up, but up against both ONL boundary and the Murphy Road boundary, that the zone is 600 or 300, you should be able to subdivide up to that level. And you know, we shouldn't be ending up in a debate with urban designers over what size lots happen along that boundary and what size lots happen elsewhere. The zoning should provide you with a development. It should be able to design, but think very carefully about to what extent the council brings in how you design it. Now, it may well be what you're saying, that there's a mechanism we have to think about, but we have a, you're allowed to achieve minimum average. If the yield doesn't change, then the issue is the points.
Is the nub of your position that the council shouldn't, the council staff shouldn't be in the position of micromanaging subdivision development?
Basically, yes. Subject to the identified urban design outcomes, which are set out in the design guidelines, things like limited number of cul-de-sacs, things like connections, things like links, things like not to be rear loss. Basically, all those basic urban design issues can be identified, and they must be listed in the design guidelines. But beyond that, if the developer can achieve those things, the developer should be free to design the subject. In the zone which has been zoned for residential development, rural lifestyle or rural residential, whether other than lost places. Because the zone basically says that's what the land is. Paragraph 14, I just record the movement of the district control of lost size largely removes the issue. Means a question from application to RDA over CA. Very quickly, on the rural lifestyle zone, without repeating written submissions, a very simple question. I referred in my legal submissions to Plan A, which was attached at the end that had been produced before, as an example of a subdivision which was achieved under the rural general fully discretionary regime. You've got the Plan A, it has a variety of lot sizes, 32 lots and 33 hectares. They range from about 0.6 of a hectare up to about 1.3 or 1.4 of a hectare. Under the current, the land is proposed to be rezoned rural lifestyle. An area need is recommended 1 hectare in this area. And what is proposed, what's shown on Plan A, will be non-compliant.
Is this a matter that goes beyond the work of the person?
Yes, that's what, when I came to you before last week, I alluded to the fact that minimum average versus minimum.
But there's what, the minimum average versus minimum is merely changing the average from 2 hectares to 1 hectare. That is all it does. It's exactly what the cities for change does. We have no evidence of anyone presenting on the effect that might have at Mount Barker, Harwea Flat, Glen Auckland.
Sorry, I think we're confusing two issues here. I wasn't sure. The 2 down to 1, the 2 hectares down to 1 hectare.
That's precisely what happens when you have minimum average of 1 hectare is an average of 1 hectare. A lot can only have one size. It can't have a minimum size and a maximum size. So within a subdivision, there is no distinction between a minimum average and a maximum average on a single subdivision. It's an average.
Okay. Current rural lifestyle is average 2 hectare,
yes.
Minimum 1.
Yes.
So that across the board, the average is one to two meters. One area of debate is whether the, I call it density, is whether the density of housing should be 1 to 1 hectare or 1 to 2 hectares. That's one area of debate. And it may well be that Washington Basin ends up, or part of the basin ends up, some aerial zones are density 1 to 1 hectare. Some aerial zones density 1 to 2 hectare. Maybe Mount Barker, Mayuna, 1 to 2 hectare. That's that issue. This issue, which isn't that issue, this issue is if in the Washington Basin or elsewhere, the density is reduced from 2 hectares to 1 hectare, the rule should be minimum average 1 hectare, not minimum.
I would say that, but fundamentally, the minimum average of 1 hectare is an average of 1 hectare. Minimum is an unnecessary word.
Oh, sorry.
Yes, it's an average of 1 hectare. So it's exactly the same.
But the word minimum is useful.
But there is no evidence from anyone of what the effect would be outside of the Washington Basin, but having an average 1 hectare subdivision in the rural lifestyle zone.
And I'm not advanced enough to know whether
where I'm coming from is we've deferred the matter of the site sizes in the Washington Basin until the council has done a study and brought it back to us. Now, I don't know what they're going to do. I would like to think that they'll do something rather finer grained than what's been done to date. And I was careful to include references to the source and structure plan in the hope that someone would identify that as a possible way forward for the Washington Basin. Now, the approach that they take will determine what has to be dealt with at that time. But I don't think there's any benefit in us hearing this argument that it's focused on the Washington Basin, because we're going to set that aside and not deal with it. And then I have to say, outside of the debate, we have no evidence to contemplate that change.
The evidence presented on that issue basically said, suspicion saying, this evidence is primarily focused on Washington Basin, but it may have relevance outside of Washington Basin, I don't know. And therefore, when the evidence was presented based on efficiency and on much other reasons, the postulated or argued that density in the lifestyle side could be reduced from 1 to 2 to 1 to 1 in the Washington Basin or perhaps elsewhere. If in fact you're saying that the panel is in the same position that there is evidence elsewhere, and yet in fact the only area where it might reduce from 1 is the Washington Basin, then I accept this issue from the Washington Basin. This issue would fall within what you deserve.
Well, maybe, but following the study, on some sites, it's smaller than one.
It could well be, yeah. My evidence is more about not what the density is, it's just that whatever the density is, it should be an average more than one. just because it denied the business line. Okay. Well, can be revisited when you have economic information and it's not being filmed out anywhere else, then have you not
Well, I think that's the more sensible way to deal with it, because I think we're at risk if we start altering rules, for instance, on how we are flat, where no one has sought any changes there, it could be unforeseen consequences.
Yeah, I'm not sure who else has sought what changes. Mm. That being the case, then,
before you go on, I do have one thought to put in your mind. When you revisit this issue we made the structure plan and whatever comes from it, I was just puzzling over your addition B, the very end of your summary. I invite you to contemplate the fact that if you deem every lot greater than 1 hectare to be 1 hectare, necessarily that means you can't have any lots less than 1 hectare if your average is going to be 1 hectare. So it's the same as having a minimum lot for each, a minimum for each lot of 1 hectare.
You've copied
that wording is a repetition of what's in the district plan at the moment.
Yes, and that may be a problem there, so
it's intended to talk about. It's intended to present people starting up for 20 hectares, cutting in half and creating a whole bunch of small lots here because they meet the average, and then coming back on the second half and doing it again. And getting twice as many as you're supposed to. That's what that wording is supposed to address. But there may be a better way of doing it.
Normally, you have an average that's greater than your single minimum. You have the average to have any value.
Oh, really? Provide your guidance as whether you wish to hear Mr. Brown and Mr. Bell separately or together. I can provide you with that. Mr. Brown has a two-page summary to read out to you. Mr. Farrell's primary business was already referring to advising Mr. Brown's evidence and basically the opportunity to make a key file later to avoid repetition. So his evidence largely supports Mr. Brown's evidence. Maybe you feel it more beneficial to question them separately together on how you were at.
Just before we proceed, given our discussion on the 1 hectare minimum by specifically the Mokopiti Basin and being declared, I think we should probably take the second half of Mr. Farrell's. Just leave the second half of Mr. Farrell's evidence to one side and to be dealt with later.
And I should also ask that my dad was sitting there, given where we've got to, the valuation evidence was directed at the minimum lot size, the discretionary control of the lot size. I've been asking the question, but I'll probably call it first and he can decide to be submitted.
Yes, I think that's what it is. And, I'll discuss with the other commissioners whether they want to have a failure at the same time or sequentially. Question I have is, can you do some evaluations in the rural genius zone? Let's just write that down. My question, Mr. Reid, is I think you heard that we do have some statistics that a reasonable number of existing of consent applications under the existing framework in both rural areas and in residential areas are in fact considered as full discretionary or non-complying activities where consent, where all issues are at large and consent could be declined. Do you value those?
That's quite interesting hearing your perception on that. We've probably had an incorrect perception that it was a medical issue that triggered discretionary or non-compliant. We've never viewed it as such a great risk to the whole subdivision of hearing. There's lots of examples where it's even being mitigated. We've got evidence of resolution being made. So it hasn't been something that things even would have become aware of in the past.
So if the result, the end result was that there was some uncertainty but within reasonable bounds, that wouldn't pose a problem for evaluation. Is that fair? And of course the trick is to know what the reasonable bounds are.
Correct. Well, we've had good examples in the past.
Thank you very much.
Can I just answer or talk to one thing? It's just for a question for we could say a certain maximum plot size to help set a boundary that, that just off the top of my head that would create a wee bit of confusion in fact of you've got galleries of secrets and land-known build areas, so your average lot size could be overinflated.
'Cause you're saying this sequentially, and I think it's probably most valuable to hear Mr. Brown says, but I'm not sure that 8 minutes if you do a trust for it. But if he has a summary to read out, perhaps he could read that out and then we'll resume.
Thank you very much. This is a summary statement to my primary evidence, and I support retaining a control activity rules framework for subdivision in the urban and rural living zones. District plans to regulate control activities as zone enables and what it does not, based on the effects of activities in the context of the objectives and policies of the zone and the wider environment. For subdivision in zones which are clearly destined for a specific purpose, such as the urban and rural living zones, I support the certainty of the control activity framework over the comparative uncertainty of the restricted discretionary or discretionary framework. The control framework provides sufficient market certainty while still providing council with sufficient powers of intervention to fine-tune a proposal such as in relation to urban design. The council's powers do not need to extend to refusal of consent where it is already deemed that the zone is appropriate for the activities that it is intended to embrace. There are two with sufficient examples to demonstrate that the Oxford Plains control activity framework was the cause of poor subdivision, then my opinion about a control activity framework and the proposed plan is wildly different. However, no concrete evidence has been presented in my view. The subdivision examples of the botanical study were all consensus prior to what I called in my primary evidence, the urban sign paradigm shift through the 2000s, but nevertheless, most of the examples achieved the majority successful acceptable urban design rating from Bob Whistle, and there is no nexus between the defects of those subdivisions that received the majority less successful rating and the control activity framework that is alleged to be the cause of those defects. Further, in light of the lack of examples of cause being the control status and effect being bad subdivision, there does not seem to me to be any fair argument for reserving the right to refuse an application is going to automatically lead to better subdivision. If there is an application for bad subdivision, Council has various powers to address it and ask for additional information on the matter, checking commission reports, checking notify, if it considers that the proposal will have adverse effects on an existing neighbourhood, such that there may be special circumstances grounds for notification, it can put the matter before independent commissioners, and it can impose conditions to achieve outcomes just these as necessary. If an applicant does not agree with the conditions or proposal, they can object to appeal. I acknowledge that there is a possibility of an uncooperative applicant who refuses to accept council guidance. In that circumstance, the council retains the power to impose conditions. If there is a specific outcome that the council wants to achieve and is entitled to assist on, then it can be conditioned. I cannot think the specific issue of desired outcomes cannot be addressed in this way, and the council witnesses have not identified an example of the problem they are concerned about. In my experience, any areas of possible or actual disagreement between an applicant and a council can then only be resolved before or during the consent process through pre-lodgement and post-lodgement meetings with staff and other parties and by presentation to the urban design panel. The end result has been acceptable suites of conditions. I do not know of any examples where this has not been the case. A control activity framework which properly reflects urban design principles can deliver quality environmental outcomes and by processing. The improved emphasis on urban design principles, as is inherent in the proposed plan objectives and policies, is a significant improvement over the operating plan. I consider the chapter 27 with the modifications I set out in my primary evidence will appropriately enable use and development in the urban and rural living zones. The matters of control are wide, and coupled with the development controls and the wide range of detailed objectives and policies to guide the assessment of any proposal, particularly in relation to urban design, framework will achieve the purpose of the Act. One final matter, Mr. Chairman. I haven't addressed in the summary, but the exchange that the panel had with Mr. Dawson about the structure of plans and decision management policies and terms of control or discretion. I touched on that in paragraphs 5.5 and 5.6 of my evidence, of my primary evidence, and I'm certainly happy to talk to you about the unitary plan in Auckland as well.
One question, Mr. Brown. You've seen Mr. Weiss's evidence, isn't that?
Yes, correct.
We assume that there may be a legal issue with regard to council control over reconfiguration of roads or access through to land for future subdivision purposes. Do you have any comment on Mr. Weiss's suggested discretion rulemaking?
Any reconfiguration?
And the 9, discretion is restricted to the following lot sizes and dimensions. Councillor?
Yes, I don't have a problem with that.
Thank you. Councillor Patricia, so I think I may ask much.
Yes.
Yes, I'll move again until 2 p.m.